Bonjour à tous, merci d'être avec nous sur cette table ronde. Bonjour à tous. On a la chance d'avoir une heure avec Joe Walton. Joe Walton qu'on vient tout juste de découvrir en France avec son premier roman traduit, Morwina, qui est quand même un roman qui a notamment eu le prix Hugo et le prix Locus. On va pouvoir en discuter ensemble. Et on va discuter aussi de ses autres romans, parce qu'elle en a une bonne dizaine à son actif. Voilà, on va pouvoir avoir une petite heure derrière nous. Est-ce que simplement au niveau de la technique, on peut baisser la musique sur le retour, s'il vous plaît, ce qu'on a là? Voilà, parce que nous, on entendait de la musique, c'était sympa, mais pas très simple. On va pouvoir balayer un petit peu et la vie et l'œuvre de Joe Walton. On a une heure pour ça ensemble. On s'intéressera donc plus particulièrement à Morwina. Vous êtes né en décembre 1964. Au Pays de Galles. Vous étiez une grosse lectrice de science-fiction et de fantasy. Je voulais savoir un petit peu votre enfance et votre enfance en tant que lectrice. Quand est-ce que vous avez découvert les livres? Quand est-ce que, quels sont les auteurs qui vous ont le plus marqué au début?
When I was a child, we had a lot of old books at home and not a lot of new books. So if I got a paperback, that was a treasure. Because most of the things that we had were from my mother's childhood and even from my grandmother's childhood. So I read a lot of Victorian children's books as a child, and I was very excited when I read a new book like the Chronicles of Narnia or something like that. And we had a finite number of books, so I read and reread the books that we did have. So whether I liked it or not, I would read it a lot of times because that's what there was. And twice a year we would go to bookshops. Once in the summer when we would be on holiday in Pembrokeshire, we would go to a bookshop and I would have money and I would buy books. And once after Christmas, I would go with whatever money I'd been given for Christmas and buy books. And those were very exciting times for me. And then I'd buy those books and I'd read them and reread them. And re-read them over the year.
En termes de science-fiction et de fantasy, parce que ça va vraiment compter après pour Morwina, quels étaient vos auteurs ou les histoires qui vous ont particulièrement marqué ou qui vous ont en tout cas donné envie d'écrire vous-même de la science-fiction et de la fantasy?
Well, in terms of childhood reading, I was reading science fiction before I knew that it was a separate thing, because I'd buy a book and I didn't realize that there was a genre called science fiction. So I read very early, I read Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea novels, and I read things like John Christopher's Prince in Waiting series and Arthur C. Clarke and a whole lot of things like that individually. But I was also reading, you know, mimetic novels and other things, and I didn't realize that there was this genre called science fiction. And then when I was 12 in the library, I thought that it would be... I'd read everything in the children's section. I'd read absolutely every book in the children's section. So I thought I would read books from the adult section, which I was not allowed to do. But I thought if I took books that were by authors who'd also written books for children, if I was caught, I could claim that they'd been misshelved. So I found Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, because I'd read the Earthsea books, so I read The Dispossessed. And then and The Lathe of Heaven. And Peter Dickinson, whose Weathermonger books I'd read, had written King and Joker, which was, most of his adult books are actually mysteries, but that one is science fiction, and it was. And that's when I realized there was a science fiction section in the library, and that science fiction was a thing, and that this was a particular genre. And then I read all of it, just like Morwenna in the book. I read the whole science fiction section in alphabetical order. Sort of from Powell Anderson to Roger Zelazny, I read everything. So, of course, if the library had gaps, I had gaps. So people say sometimes to me, oh, why does she never read Brian Aldiss? Why does she never read Michael Moorcock? And it's because I didn't find those writers until I was an adult, because they weren't in the library and I didn't run across them. So if nobody told me to read them later, or at least I didn't read them until somebody told me to read them.
À quoi ressemblait l'enfance et l'adolescence de Jo Walton? Évidemment, ma question n'est pas innocente avec Morwina.
Yeah, very. A lot of that book is actually based on my life. It's sort of semi-autobiographical. Yeah, not the magic, okay. Don't ask me if I really see fairies. People ask me that sometimes. But yeah, a lot of the certainly the reading is autobiographical. I really read those books. To a certain extent, I shaped it for the book so that she reads particular books at particular times that to do with her development and what's happening in the story. But a lot of it is my memories of reading those books, and I just put that in autobiographically, which was quite difficult actually when I was writing it, because it's very easy to find out when a book was first published in English in the US. But when the first British edition was, it's harder. And the first British paperback, because it was paperbacks that I was reading and that she was buying, that's actually very challenging to find out. So that was, I had to do quite a lot of research, because when I was using my memories, they were my memories of anything from 1979 to like 1982. And the book just covers 6 months, so I needed to know what was out in that 6 months.
Et en termes d'ambiance et de paysage, qu'est-ce qu'il y a de vous dans Morwina?
Oh, the landscape is all real. I mean, those places are all real. You can go there. And actually, this is true of all my books. Every place that's in any of my books is a real place where you can just go and walk around, and that's the atmosphere. I always use real places, even if I'm running in a secondary world. The places are real places.
Une petite question, pareil, alors toujours sur le pays de Galles de votre enfance, vous parlez de gallois.
Yeah, well, not right now. Right now, I only speak really bad French. Yes. No, Welsh I sort of speak, but I never get the opportunity to speak it to anybody, so I've forgotten all my vocabulary. I used to speak it when I was a child, but now I speak it really, really badly, and French words come out when I want a Welsh word.
Est-ce que ça a une influence sur votre imaginaire ou votre manière d'écrire cette langue qui est un petit peu différente, qui n'est pas latine?
Welsh? I don't know. It's very difficult. And I think for anybody who's bilingual or who has a second language, it does have an influence on the way that you look at English, on the way that you construct language. But I don't know. It's very difficult to tell because I don't have a control Joe who didn't have the Welsh influence early, so it's difficult to know. But I think you can tell a difference, particularly in English, I think you can tell a difference between somebody who is a monolingual Anglophone who only speaks English and somebody who's got another language, whatever the other language is. I think you can see more fluidity and flexibility in the way of speaking English and when it comes to creating languages and using names and things like that. And I've seen that with other writers, and I think I do have that. So I think that's a good thing that I got from it. But Welsh is a tiny minority language, even in Wales. Most Welsh people don't really speak it. If you go to Wales, everybody speaks English, even if they speak Welsh at home. So it's not a very practical language to know. I wish I'd grown up speaking some great world language.
Peut-être revenir au début de Morwina, quelle était un petit peu l'idée de départ et votre intention avec ce livre?
Okay, I wrote an essay which is still on my life journal, which is called The Industrial Landscape of Elfland. And I wrote this because people have this, particularly Americans, have this kind of strange imagination of Wales as a magical place. And where I grew up, it's really not very magical. It is a post-industrial landscape. But yet, at the same time, it is magical because everywhere is magical. And you can see the magic in any kind of landscape. But it's a post-industrial magic and not this kind of Celtic, fakey thing. You must get this here, actually, in Brittany, because you have standing stones, and therefore you've got a kind of magic in a landscape, whereas you've also got factories where people make things. And it's modern as well as being ancient at the same time, and in a way that a lot of people in North America don't understand very well. So I would get preconceptions about being Welsh in Canada and particularly in the US. And so I wanted to write about the part of Wales that I came from and what it was really like. And I suddenly got this idea for writing this essay about this. And saying that I imagined it as a fantasy landscape, but actually it was a landscape of the chrysalids. It's a post-apocalyptic landscape. So I wrote this piece, which is a pretty good essay. And hundreds of people, I mean, like literally 70 people, commented on it and said, you should make this into a book. And I thought, oh, you are so silly. How could I make this into a book? This is just an essay about where I come from and the context of my life. And there's no story there. There's just a description of landscape and preconceptions and misconceptions of landscape. And then Michelle Segarra West, who is a Canadian fantasy writer, said, you should make this into a book. And I thought, oh, Michelle, you should know better than this. You write books yourself. You know what you need to write a book. And then I was making dinner, and I'd just seen this comment. And I thought, oh, how could she possibly think I could make this into a book? What kind of book could I possibly make it into? And then I thought, well, I guess I could. And the story that would be there would be an autobiographical story or a semi-autobiographical story about fairies and about growing up inside books and how books help you to grow up in a way that is not an escapist way. The book has been described as a female intellectual coming of age, which is an unusual thing because usually you get intellectual coming of age for men, and women only get to have emotional coming of age stories. And I think that is one of the reasons why this book has been popular and successful and that people like it, because that is an unusual thing. But I thought, oh, well, that would be an interesting thing to do, and that would be weird. But are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to talk about real books in fiction? Can you do that? And I thought, okay, this would be a way I could use a particular magic system which I had thought of, in which everything in the world is connected together and everything is connected to landscape. And I thought, I'm so sick of Celtic stuff. I'm going to do this where I'm not using Celtic stuff, but I'm writing in the Welsh landscape. And I'm tired of people doing true names for magic and names being everything. I'm going to do this where the magic doesn't even have nouns, which was a big challenge, actually. The fairies don't have names and they don't use nouns. And you try writing dialogue where you have no nouns. It must have been terrible for the poor translator, because this would be even worse in French. I feel so sorry for all my translators having to deal with this. It was difficult enough writing it in the first place. So that's what I did. And I actually wrote it quite quickly once I started to write it. And my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, was very, very enthusiastic. I was sending it to him as I was writing it, and he was very enthusiastic about it, which was great because I had been thinking maybe this is too weird. But quite often when I write a book, I think maybe it's too weird. Oh, well, if the worst comes to the worst and nobody wants it, I can always put it online. That'll be okay. So I was not expecting it to be a book that so many people would fall in love with. I thought the people would read it and they would think, well, she's a very weird character. That's kind of interesting. And they'd read it the way that people read Elizabeth Moon's Speed of Dark, where there's an autistic character. An autistic point of view character, and I thought people would read it like that. Whereas, in fact, an awful lot of people have read it and they identify with Maury. They feel close to her. They see something of their own experience. So that was quite interesting for me to realize in my late 40s that I'm not actually as weird as I thought I was, you know, that I'm more normal, that my experience is more mirrored in many Fanish people's experience, the experience of many readers.
Comment est-ce que vous dites que les lecteurs s'identifient à Morwina? Comment est-ce que vous la voyez, votre héroïne? Elle est comment pour vous?
I'm sorry.
Comment est-ce que vous présenteriez votre héroïne? Comment est-ce que vous la voyez, Morwina?
Okay. Well, she's 15 and she is half of a pair of twins and her sister is dead. And most of her life is inside books. And one of the things that I always say about her is that she's a science fiction reader with fantasy problems. So she lives in a world with magic and fairies. It's our world, but it has magic and fairies, and the magic is very complicated. And science fiction is the answer to a lot of her problems. Her reading and the way that she approaches reading helps her understand the world, not just the fantasy problems, but the real world problems that she has, her human interactions. So she's a science fiction reader in a world with fantasy problems, where the fantasy is the problem and the science fiction is the answer. So that's how I think of that.
Allez-y. Problème de casque, donc vous avez compris, avec un chapeau. Il y a beaucoup, beaucoup de références d'ouvrages dont vous parlez dedans. Alors, est-ce que c'était un plaisir de citer tous ces auteurs et tous ces ouvrages? Et est-ce que c'est aussi un roman sur la connivence avec tous les lecteurs de science-fiction et de fantasy?
It's really what I just said, that a lot of her life takes place as a reader. And I just wanted, the books needed to be in there. If I was going to represent my experience as a teenager, if I was going to represent her experience, then the books needed to be there. And they needed to be real books, because who could make that up? I mean, you couldn't make up the whole of a... Maybe Samuel Delaney could make up the whole of a culture and the whole of a literature, but it would be beyond me. So it's not about my... It's not talking to the other books. It's not about my relationship with the books or the authors. It's about every teenager's experience of discovering science fiction and just plunging into it. And the way that you read good books and bad books, and you develop taste as you're going along. I certainly did that. You know, and she reads some terrible books. People have made a bibliography of the books that are in here, and some people are saying they're going to try to read all those books. And if I'd imagined that anybody would have done that, I would have been much more careful. It's not meant as a reading list. I mean, she reads Piers Anthony. She reads what she comes across and what people give her and all kinds of things quite indiscriminately, in the way that I think I certainly did at that age, and that a lot of us did at that age. And at the end of that process, you have taste. But at the beginning, you didn't.
Est-ce qu'on peut dire que quelque part tous ces livres-là sont aussi une manière d'expliquer sa personnalité?
Yeah. Yeah. In a way, the books are what lets her develop personality and individuality, and that she can escape into the books, but also that she can use the books as building blocks to understand the world.
C'est un roman qui a eu beaucoup de prix, hein. On l'a vu, notamment le prix Hugo, le prix Nebula et le British Fantasy Award. Quelle est l'importance pour vous de ces récompenses? Et ce n'est pas les seules que vous ayez eues, hein, vous en avez eu beaucoup d'autres.
Yes. Well, it's a great honor to win any award. It's wonderful that people like it, and it's a way of people showing that they really, really do like and appreciate a book. So it was great that it won the British Fantasy Award, and recently it won the German award, the Kurd Laßwitz Prize, and that was, you know, it was, I was pleased and excited that I won that, and the same also with the Nebula. It was very, very nice of the Science Fiction Writers of America to give me their award, and I felt very honoured. But the one that was really deeply meaningful to me is the Hugo, because the Hugo is awarded by fandom. And it's voted on by everybody who goes to the World Science Fiction Convention, and it's a big major award. But I'd written a series of blog posts on Tor.com about the history of the Hugos, and I'd looked at every year from 1953 to 2000, and I'd looked at the five Hugo nominees and considered whether they were the best books of the year for that year. I'm now in the process of compiling these posts into a book, which is going to be called An Informal History of the Hugos. And that'll be out from Tor next year, I think. But anyway, I'd already written this. I wrote that in 2010, before the book came out. So after writing that, to actually win the Hugo was a very significant thing for me. And also, you may have noticed this year and in other years, there have been people campaigning to be nominated for the Hugo and that kind of thing. And I've always abominated that, and I never do anything to campaign for any award. I think it's completely meaningless to win an award if you've campaigned for it. It's like saying, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And then if you finally say, yeah, I love you, it's meaningless. And it's like that with awards. So the fact that I didn't campaign at all, not even slightly, I didn't even, you know, list my eligibility or anything, but yet it won the Hugo, and it won it over such excellent competition, George R. R. Martin, China Mieville, you know, terrific books. That was very, very significant to me, and that made me very, very, very happy and excited. I'm still very excited when I see my Hugo on the table. I think, my Hugo, wow. it's just great.
Et est-ce que ça ne met pas une pression supplémentaire quand on est écrivain et qu'on a gagné autant de prix et qu'on se remet à écrire, hein? Est-ce qu'ils sont pas, y a pas des petites idées derrière la tête à chaque fois?
Well, I think when this happens to people with a first book or an early book, I think it can make them get very swelled headed. And also, as you say, it puts pressure on you that people are looking at your next book in a completely different way. But this was, among others, was my ninth book. And so I was quite used to producing books that, you know, a couple of thousand people read and that did okay, but that weren't a giant success. So I just see this as an aberration. This is never going to happen to me again. I accidentally wrote a book that sort of got a fanish zeitgeist in a way that'll probably never happen. And all of my books are different from each other. I have written things that are in series, three books in a series. But if you look at that as being one thing, which is the way that I look at it, all of my books are different from each other. They're in different subgenres. They're quite different styles. And I get bored easily. So people ask me to write a sequel to this, and I think that will be impossible. I'm not interested in doing that. That's not something I could do. So my next book, my most recently published book, My Real Children, is an alternate history about a woman who has dementia, and she is 90, and she remembers two different versions of her own life. And she's trying to remember which of them is real. So there are two alternate versions of the 20th century in that book. And in one of them, everything goes sort of a bit better than in our world, and in the other one, everything goes like a little bit worse. So in one world, there's kind of mini Suez, and in the other one, there's hyper Suez. And after hyper Suez, Britain joins the EU when it is forming first, at the Treaty of Rome. So Britain is always in Europe in that world, and everything is very, very different and goes very differently. And in the other world, the Soviet Union has a very, very peaceful disintegration and becomes part of Europe, and it's just all different in both worlds. But it's all focused on her life. So these things are happening in the background of her falling in love and marrying or not marrying and falling in love with somebody different and having this kind of thing. So it's written like a feminist women's novel, and not really like a science fiction novel. So you write something like that, and you know it's not going to have the same kind of reception as a book like this, as a fantasy novel, because it's just a different kind of book. And because all of my books are different, I don't expect them to get the same sort of response. It's great when something is successful and everybody reads it and people come up to me and tell me that they love it. But I know I'm not going to repeat this. I understand that. So that is okay.
Là, on est en train, vous l'avez vu, on est en train de commencer à explorer la partie qu'on ne connaît pas encore en France, la partie qui est inédite en anglais. Mm-hmm. Je voudrais qu'on revienne, il y a un titre qui est en train de sortir en ce moment, c'est The Just City. La mise en place d'une...
In French? Denoël are doing my Small Change trilogy. Farthing, which is going to be called La Circule du Farthing. Halfpenny and Half a Crown. I don't know what French names they'll have yet. But they're publishing those. And they came out originally in 2006, 2007, and 2008 in the US. And they've just come out in Britain like 5 minutes ago this year. So those will be out in France. I don't think that anything else is scheduled yet to come out in France. But of course, I'd be delighted... I'm really excited for things to be published in French because I live in Montreal, and so all of my friends, the first thing when I said this Morwenna was coming out in French, the first thing they all said was, I'll buy it for my mother, because because all in Montreal, it's a French city, but many young people are bilingual and read in both languages, but older people not so much. So their mothers, you know, they want it in French. So, yeah, I really want books in French. It's so great for my social life.
Restons justement sur cette trilogie, c'est intéressant parce qu'on va pouvoir la lire bientôt en français, qui s'appelle donc Small Change. Mm-hmm. C'est une uchronie. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous donner l'idée un petit peu de départ?
Yes. Okay, well, in that trilogy, it's a world where the Second World War ended in May of 1941 with the Hess mission, where Hitler sent Hess to Britain in real life. And Hess was imprisoned then forever until he died. But in this world, the British accepted the peace that he was offering, which was essentially, let's call it a draw. Everybody keep what they've got. So May of 1941, France was occupied, the Low Countries were occupied. Britain still had the empire, but Hitler had the continent. So let's call it a draw in May of 41, before the US came into the war in December of 41. Britain had no way to win. And Hitler couldn't understand it. He made this peace offer three times in reality, through Sweden, through the Pope, and then the Hess mission. Basically, why don't we just stop fighting because you can't win, we don't want to invade you. Yeah. And the books are set in, the first two are set in 1949 and the third one is set in 1960. In this world where it just stops at that point. And Britain is becoming more fascist and sliding into fascism. And they are... Farthing is a country house mystery. It's like Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and things like that, because it occurred to me that you read those books and they're actually about violent death. But they're written in a way where they're actually about cups of tea and crumpets and slippers by the fireside and people falling in love. But the death is kind of glossed over, even though people are trying to discover who killed somebody and why. It's all nice in a very English kind of way. So I thought I could write about fascism in that way, and I could write about it in England, and I could write about it in that way where there is food and clothes and people in love and these kinds of things. But it's actually about evil. About how good people do evil things, about how we do evil things and allow evil things to be done in our name. And that's what those three books are about. And they're about a world that is getting darker. But on the surface, it's all lovely. The third book in the first chapter of the third book, where there's been 10 more years of this, and it's 1960, there's a big peace treaty, a big peace conference going on in London, in which the Soviets have been completely defeated and the world's being carved up by the fascist states, basically, and they're having this peace conference. And the first person female young character says, isn't it fun to be a fascist? And that's a sentence that you would think nobody ever uttered in real life, but in fact they did, you know. You look at the Nuremberg rallies, those people are having fun, they're not being coerced. And if you look at the Mitford sisters, Diana Mosley, she said, poor dear Hitler, you know. That people talked like that, and they acted like that. And it's interesting to think about what makes people act like that and not think that they're bad people. It's very easy within genre. We've got a lot of stories about evil, but evil is very, it's very much a shadow. You don't see evil. You don't understand why people are evil. And I think it's an interesting question of why people are evil and why people do evil and how they can live with themselves in doing that. And that's largely what that series is about.
Est-ce qu'il y a un plaisir à jouer avec l'histoire en tant qu'écrivain? C'est pas votre première uchronie?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Expliquez-nous.
Yeah. All of my books are informed by history, and yes, I enjoy playing with history and doing different things with history. And also, Ken MacLeod said, history is the secret, the trade secret of science fiction. And when you're using history, you can lean on real history and the complexities, the fractal complexities of real history. That when you're just making it up, things are correspondingly simpler because you don't have those kinds of weirdnesses that actually happen in real life. That's why I find fantasy, where I could use history, easier than science fiction, where I'm supposed to make it all up, figure it all out. It's a lot more work, it's a lot more difficult. And it slows me down a lot.
Et justement, en ce moment, alors dans quelques semaines, je ne sais pas s'il est déjà sorti, vous avez un nouveau roman qui sort, qui s'appelle The Just City.
Yes, it's coming out in January. Yeah, okay, so The Just City, it's the first idea that I ever had for a novel. And I wrote the original version of this book when I was 16. And the idea of this book is time travelers setting up Plato's Republic. And on the one hand, it's a crazy idea. And on the other hand, I can't understand why everybody didn't already write it. I feel like everybody should have written a version of this book. It ought to be a whole subgenre where people write about people setting up Plato's Republic. So it's a fantasy novel. It has the goddess Athene granting the prayers of everybody who ever prayed to her to help set up Plato's Republic. And that's about 300 people from all of time, from right after Plato, through to into our near future. They've got to have read the Republic in Greek in order to have done this, so that when they get there, they can all speak Greek. And then they buy 10,080 Greek-speaking slave children, 10 years old, because Plato says you should begin with 10-year-olds, because Plato didn't know children very well. And I think he imagined the 10-year-olds would know nothing and be complete blank slates, which is so not the case. And so the novel is from the point of view of one of these people who prayed to help set it up, a Victorian young lady who is a blue stocking and she reads Greek and she just can't have a life of the mind in the world that she lives in. So she's one of the point of view characters. And another one is one of the children who is bought and taken there and brought up to become a philosopher king in Plato's Republic. And the other point of view is the god Apollo, who decides to incarnate himself and live in the Republic and grow up there and experience being human. And I had so much fun with this book, but what it's actually about is volition. It's about free will. and consent and all of that kind of thing. And it's funny. It is an amusing book about free will and consent and this kind of thing. And that's coming out in January, and there is a sequel which I have written called The Philosopher Kings, which is coming out sometime. And I am presently working on a third book, which is called Necessity.
Un petit mot peut-être sur la nouvelle qu'on trouve dans l'anthologie des Utopiales, Sleepers, qui s'appelle, qu'on a traduit par En sommeil en français. De quoi parle-t-elle?
Okay, it's called Sleeper in English because it is about a Soviet sleeper agent, or somebody who might have been a Soviet sleeper agent. It's about somebody being created as an artificial intelligence in the future, a guy who was a Soviet agent in Britain and who outlived the Soviet Union and died, but now in the future is being recreated as an artificial intelligence to be an appendix to a biography, really, what it's like to be him and in that world. And I wrote that story very quickly, and I had a lot of fun writing it. And it's an idea that I'd had for a long time, the idea of, you know, Philby Burgess and MacLean, the Soviet spies that they had, and they were undercover. And if they had more of them, what happened to them in 1989? And what would it feel like to be somebody who'd been undercover for decades and then have the country to whom you were in service just vanish in that way? And what would that be like? And I've been thinking about that for a long time, and I've been thinking maybe sometime I'd write a novel about that. But it didn't have enough. It was just the idea of this character. And so somebody said, well, you could write a short story. And I thought, okay, I'll write a short story. So it's just a short story about that. A short story is just one idea. And that's just one idea.
Et en plus, elle est toute récente. Vous m'avez dit qu'elle venait d'être publiée au mois d'août, c'est ça?
That's right, yes. I wrote it in June, I think. May? No, April. I wrote it in April. And it came out in August on the Tor.com site, and now in French. So it's in French almost as fast as it is in English, for a change.
Ce qu'on sait moins, c'est que vous écrivez aussi pas mal de poésie. Parlez-nous un petit peu de vos poèmes.
I write poetry. Poetry is my natural form. I write poetry all the time. It's what I can't help writing. I write science fiction poetry and fantasy poetry, and I write poetry about all the things everybody writes poetry about: life and death and the weather and food and all of those kinds of things. And I put it on my life journal, so a lot of my journal is poetry. And sometimes I sell it, and sometimes I don't, and sometimes I don't even try. I just write it. It's just a thing that I do. It really does come very naturally to me. If I want to express myself about something important, it's often easier for me to write a poem than it is to talk. It's easier to write it with line breaks in a form than it is to just say whatever it is that's important that I want to say. I've recently been writing this last year and a half. I've been writing a sonnet cycle called Death Sucks. And whenever somebody I know dies, I write another poem in this Death Sucks sonnet cycle. Because death, it sucks. You know, you may have noticed this. It sucks. And we live in a very secular world. But that means that when people die, we don't have anywhere to go. We don't have any means of dealing with this because We become sort of pseudo-religious, even though we're not religious at all in our normal lives. I don't mean people who are religious. I mean people who are, in their normal life, they're completely not religious. But they when somebody dies, when they're faced with death, the only thing they can think of to deal with that is a religious way of dealing with it, because the secular society doesn't give you any way of dealing with it. So I'm writing these poems as secular humanist death sucks poems as a way of dealing with that.
Est-ce que le processus d'écriture est le même entre la poésie, les romans, les nouvelles? C'est la même manière de travailler ou c'est des choses qui sont complètement différentes?
Well, the thing with poetry is that generally poems are fairly short, though actually I've written some pretty epic poems. So you can write them quickly. So you can just sit down and write it and you can think, I will be done with this today. It doesn't inhabit you in the way that a novel does. Normally, a novel takes me about a year to write, though last year I wrote 3 books, so it varies a lot. And that's the main difference. A novel, you're thinking about it all the time because it takes you a long time. Whereas a short story or a poem, you can see the end of it. It's finite. You can do it right now. You don't have to stop and spend time doing other things while you're doing it. But my actual process of composition is very much the same. And also when I write blog posts or whatever, it's very much the same. I don't really think of these. Everything has its own specific mode, but every novel has a different mode, a different style. And so every book, I've got to learn how to write that book, and knowing how to write the previous book didn't help. And it's the same with everything. But I'd say that things are more different from each other individually than from each other as different things. Did that make any sense?
Et justement, vous parliez de votre blog. Vous êtes plutôt présente sur Internet. C'est une autre manière. C'est pour vous une autre facette de votre travail d'écrivain, ou c'est une autre manière de communiquer avec les lecteurs?
Yes, and also it's a way of communicating with my friends and people that I want to talk to. It's a lot of my social life is online. People sometimes advise writers to have a blog to communicate with readers as a marketing tool, and I think that's a terrible idea. Because if you do it and you don't want to do it, then it's a terrible waste of time. If you do want to do it, it's different. And I do it because it's fun. I get to hang out with friends and readers and both, you know, there's a larger overlap here. And the blogging that I do on Tor.com, where I write about old books on Tor.com, which have recently been collected. I have a collection in English which is called What Makes This Book So Great? The very grown-up title. And I get paid for that, so that's like another income stream for me. But even so, I wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. It's only really worth doing because it is fun. But I do like being available to readers. I like it that readers can email me if they've got a question about something. I had email yesterday from somebody who has an unusual name that I used for a minor character in my real children, and she just read the book and run across her name, and she said, I never met anybody else with my name. Where did you get it from? And I said, I got it from a 13th century Provençal princess. Where did you get it from? And, you know, that's nice. It's nice to have those kinds of interactions. And when you write full-time, you're at home full-time, and you're not going out to work, and you're not having the kind of water cooler interactions with other people, so it's nice to have that online. And with other writers, so that I can see other writers posting their word count and talking about being stuck, and it makes me feel less like this is a very weird thing to be doing. Why don't I have a job like normal people? Because there's other people also writing. So I encourage that. I think that's great.
Il nous reste un petit quart d'heure. On va peut-être passer aux questions. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question dans la salle? Peut-être, oui, monsieur.
Oui, bonjour. Je voulais savoir, quand vous écrivez, est-ce que vous prenez en compte la diversité de votre lectorat, que ce soit dans le monde anglophone en général ou ailleurs, ainsi que les éventuelles difficultés pour les traducteurs que vous avez mentionnées également?
I probably should, but no, I don't. I imagine my readers to be the kind of people who read science fiction. And people said sometimes, with among others, with Morwenna, people said, well, is this going to be accessible to people who don't read science fiction? And I was just confused because nobody had ever asked me that before in my other 8 books. Is this a requirement? You know, why are you worried about this? Because who's going to read it except people who read science fiction? It's a science fiction book. It's a fantasy book. So my imagination of my readers is only that they're going to be reading it in English and that they're going to be kind of the kind of people who read these kinds of books. And I hope that it is accessible to other people. And it's great when it is. But I'm not thinking about that. I'm not thinking that. And I think if I did, it would be bad because I'd think, I should simplify this because a Chinese person won't know what I mean. I shouldn't talk about whales because people have never heard of whales. And it's true, people have never heard of whales. Even in Canada, people have never heard of whales. Or they've only got this very strange conception of it. And I should be writing things. And I think if you try to do that, if you try to write for absolutely everybody, what you end up with is very bland and without flavor. But I do try to think when I write minor characters, okay, not everybody is English speaking, not everybody is white, not everybody is young, not everybody is fit. You know, there's a piece of writing advice they give you that if you don't know what to do, you should have a man come through the door with a gun. And my answer to that is, well, why a man? Why not a woman come through the door with a gun? Why not a kid come through the door with a gun? Why not an old person in a wheelchair come through the door with a gun? Why is an old woman in a wheelchair coming through the door with a gun? That's a much more interesting set of questions. Is she Japanese? Is she from New Guinea? Why would that be interesting? And so what's the interesting answer? So I do think about diversity in that sense, but not so much when I'm thinking about audience. With, among others, the translators sometimes have been in touch with me to ask me questions, and then I just feel really sorry for them. It must have been a very difficult book to translate. My Polish translator was emailing me all the time, and he ended up putting footnotes for all of the titles of the books, if they were published in Polish, to say who published them and when. You know, that's just wonderful, but so much work. I hope they get paid extra. I just think my translator should get extra bonuses. I hope you're listening.
Yeah. Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question? Peut-être une réaction à des gens qui auraient lu Morwina. Oui.
Parce que vous avez parlé un peu de la trilogie Small Change, je vais essayer de pas trop dévoiler parce que je l'ai lu moi. À un moment, vous parlez d'un événement qui serait une sorte d'incendie du Reichstag. Est-ce que ça vous était inspiré par l'actualité juste avant que vous ayez écrit vos livres ou est-ce que c'est comme ça
Yeah, I wrote Farthing very fast. It's the fastest book that I've ever written. I wrote it in 19 days in May of 2004. And, yeah, that's right. At the time when the country of my citizenship, the UK, and a prime minister that I'd voted for, Tony Blair, were illegally invading Iraq, and the results of what they were doing was starting to come out. And if I'd been in Britain, I would probably have been on marches like a lot of my friends. But I was in Canada, and Canada wisely kept itself out of that war. And my husband, who was with me, is Irish, and Ireland also kept itself out of that war. So I felt very isolated, really, in how I felt about that, that the UK and the US were doing this. And I was brought up by my grandparents, and the defining event of my grandparents' life was World War II. They got married in 1938, and World War II kind of cut their lives in half. And also, I read a lot about World War II and a lot about the 30s. And so one of the things that I felt in 2003, 2004, is as if we were becoming Hitler's Germany. We were the same as when Hitler invaded Poland. We were invading Iraq for our own reasons. And so, yes, a lot of that fed into writing Farthing. I felt as if when you read things about the 30s, people write very smugly about the 30s, very smugly about the war, as if they're saying, oh, we are better than that. We know better. We succeeded. We're the good guys. As if we're always and inevitably the good guys, and as if we could never be the bad guys. And so, yeah, seeing us as the bad guys was one of the things that certainly fed into what I wanted to do with those books. And what I was doing, and yeah, everything is written in the time that it is written. Everything is affected by current events and the writer's perception of the world. And certainly that's where I was at that point, and that's how I felt. But on the other hand, I'm a very positive, optimistic person, and in a way, that's why I wrote those books. If I was a despairing kind of person, I wouldn't have felt they were worth writing.
Y a-t-il une autre question ? On a un petit peu de temps. Oui.
C'est pas vraiment une question, c'est une remarque par rapport à l'idée que le livre Morwenna était sur l'idée d'une jeune fille qui grandit intellectuellement. Et ce que j'ai trouvé très intéressant, c'est la façon dont finalement cette idée de grandir intellectuellement, elle est aussi mise en lien avec le côté émotionnel, puisque notamment la scène où elle rencontre les gens à la bibliothèque, où elle va parler, enfin trouver quelqu'un à qui parler de ce qu'elle a ressenti intellectuellement. Finalement, émotionnellement, c'est aussi une scène très forte.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I didn't realize I was doing this when I was writing it, but I think when I wrote that scene, that's something a lot of people have said to me since. That's a fundamental experience, again, that a lot of us have had, where we'd read a lot of books and we didn't have anybody to talk to about them, and then we came somewhere like this, or to a book group or something, or we found a forum online, where people would take us seriously when we were talking about them, and then we felt that connection and that joy. And yeah, that is a very emotional, thing. And certainly, I did not, in fact, that is not something that's autobiographical in the book. I didn't find fandom or anybody to talk to or take me seriously for years after that stage of my life, until I was in my early 20s, really, before I met people that I could talk to about books. But it was a very emotional and exciting thing for me when that did happen, and certainly, yeah, that fed into the book. But what I meant by intellectual coming of age is that she does mature emotionally during the course of the story, but it's not that she finds love, it's that she finds books. And it's not that she finds relationships, or one relationship, though she does, it's that she finds people that she can talk to, and that's what's important to her.
Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question dans la salle ? Dites-nous, on a encore le temps pour une ou deux questions. Personne ? Ah. Non. Bon. Une question. Je vais revenir avec les du coup. Une dernière question. Est-ce que vous pourriez faire éventuellement un roman en dehors de la science-fiction et de la fantasy ?
No, I think that'd be very boring. I think I never have ideas that are outside science fiction and fantasy. And when I do, they quickly become fantastical. And I think it was Lisa Tuttle who said that the weirdest story in the world is the story about a universe where everything is exactly the same as this world, except there's one street in London that's new, and in that street, in one house, somebody is committing adultery. And that's a horror story. And it's just dull, you know? I don't think stories of people's everyday life are necessarily boring, but I just think it's so much more interesting if you've got better answers. So if I'm reading a Victorian novel or a contemporary novel, I don't necessarily know what's going to happen, but I can be fairly sure that there won't be an alien invasion. Or if they think there might be a ghost, there won't be a ghost. And it's so much more interesting if there could be an alien invasion or a ghost or whatever. If the space of answers that you can have is wider within the fantastic, okay, you've just got more possibilities for kinds of stories that you can tell. I wrote a Victorian novel, Tooth and Claw, where all the characters are dragons. And that's just more interesting than a Victorian novel where all the characters are human, because we've already got lots of those, you know. And so I'm just more interested in wider answers, different answers, more interesting answers about the age-old questions of what it means to be human. I'm just interested in new answers, more interested in finding a space for answers that is a more interesting space.
Et ben voilà, on arrive à la fin de cette table ronde. Merci à tous d'avoir écouté. Merci à Joe Walton. Vous pouvez la retrouver tout de suite en dédicace.
Thank
Merci.
You. Thank you.